And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ AM 1400, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is burning issues. My first guest wrote a biography of one of the greatest financial reformers after the crash of 1929. His name was Ferdinand Pecora, and we looked at the impact of reform both then and today. My next guest, Mike Farrell, is a famous actor who will talk about the need for reform in our political discourse and human rights. If you want to join the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008. Most of you know Mike Farrell from the popular TV series MASH, but fewer know that Mike Farrell is more than just his character B.J. Honeycutt. He was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, which I guess gives him the great everyman appeal that he has. He graduated from Hollywood High, did a stint in the Marine Corps, Semper Fi. Then he did some stage roles, eventually got onto the soap opera Days of Our Lives, where he starred as Scott Banning for a couple of years. After that, his next big role was MASH. He did 8 years on the show as MASH as B.J. Honeycutt. Not only did he act, but he also got the opportunity to write and direct several episodes, earned him nominations for the Directors Guild and also for Emmy Awards. Then he went into documentaries, married his current wife, Shelley Fabre, and the list goes on and on and on. Mike's entering into a new play right now, and I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about that during the course of the interview as well. Welcome to the show, Mike Farrell. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, thanks.
Well, it's great to have you on the show, and as I said, today we're talking about burning issues. Before we get to burning issues, though, I would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about your role at MASH. That's what most people know you for, is B.J. Honeycutt. You had other roles before that, but you were B.J. Honeycutt, and I identified with you in that particular role as B.J. Honeycutt. What was the best part, and what was the worst part of being B.J. Honeycutt in MASH?
There was certainly no worst part.
That's good to hear.
One of the best experiences of my life, and certainly the finest professional experience I'll ever have. But just being part of that wonderful cast and that extraordinary adventure in television was something that will never be met again, I think, under any circumstances, and certainly not surpassed.
Now, what made MASH so enduring? I mean, why do we keep watching the reruns over and over again when they're on TV?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the writing has to be credited. Larry Gelbart set the show on its course for the first 4 years, and the rest of the writers that came in kind of maintained that pace and maintained the intelligence. They never talked down to the audience. There was always this sense that we were speaking to an intelligent people, a group of people out there, unlike most of television. And Gene Reynolds, the producer who actually was the creator of the show, once said that it was the perfect existential situation. He said, not everybody puts on a uniform, not everybody goes to war, but everybody understands being away from their family, being away from home, doing something that needs to be done even at great personal cost. And I think that's right. I think people get it, that the people in MASH on some levels represent themselves.
Well, and that was one of the interesting parts about your role as B.J. Honeycutt, was it brought home the fact that you were away from home, that you had Peg, the wife, and the children back in Mill Valley, and it was extraordinarily powerful, more so than the earlier episodes where the guys were mostly single and they didn't have that family connection.
Yeah, well, it was one of the reasons that they wanted to change when I came on aboard. When Wayne left, they wanted to change outlook of the character that came in, B.J. And they asked me. I said, you know, I don't want to be Trapper. I don't want to play the same kind of character, or play the same character, which would be Death. And they said, no, we have in mind a guy who's married and has a child at home and doesn't want to be a womanizer, wants to stay faithful to his family. How do you feel about that? And I said, are you kidding?
That was right up your alley.
And I think that's a fabulous idea.
That's great. Mike, in what ways are you similar to B.J. Honeycutt?
Well, we're the same height.
Good one. All right, you got me there.
You know, one draws on one's own character, but of course there are aspects of the character that were drawn for me. So I think of B.J. as a dear and close friend whom I admire greatly and hope to be someday half the man he is.
Well, I think you are. We're talking to Mike Farrell, everybody. He's also the author of a book. It's called Just Call Me Mike. It's out in paperback, forward by Martin Sheen, and you can find that at bookstores just in time for your holiday giving. I'm remiss, Mike. I did not talk about the role that you played on Providence. You were the veterinarian Jim Hansen there on that particular show. That was all the way back in 1998 now, hard to believe. What did you like about that particular role in Providence?
It was a show that was about something. I'd been offered, as you can imagine, after MASH, any number of shows, and none of them came up to the standards that that MASH created in my mind in terms of what was possible in television. And when the Providence script came to me, it was a show about a family, but a show that was able to look at things both seriously and comedically. And I thought, well, what a wonderful thing! It'll never get on the air, but but what a wonderful thing! And when they asked me to do it, I said I'd be thrilled to do it, but I can't imagine that the studios are going to buy this. And ultimately they did, and we were on for 5 years. It should have been on for a year longer, in my view. But
5 years is a good long run, Mike.
It was, yeah.
Can't argue with that.
No.
Well, as I said at the outset, every show's got a theme. Today's theme is burning issues. Mm-hmm. And I do want to get into the burning issues with you, because you are a well-known political activist. And you're on record as saying freedom of speech is not free. And I did a whole show on this a while back with some political commentators. But I want to ask you, what is the state of political and social discourse in the United States today?
Well, I don't think it'd be surprised to anybody to say that it's a tragic state today. There is, I think, a reasonable argument that can be made for people's anger and people's confusion, starting with the attack on September 11th, 2001.
Sure. Yeah.
I feel that that set us on a course of a kind of a national case of post-traumatic stress disorder, in which people were simply off balance and frightened, and unfortunately, I think the administration in power at that time took advantage of that and exacerbated people's fears. And in so doing, we've gotten off course as a nation. Societal connections have been shredded, and people fear each other and are trying, as a result, to protect themselves from each other, and in some instances, to get over on other people. And the rise of this crazy movement that's happening now,
the Tea Party movement?
Well, yeah. Now, I don't want to label everybody who's a Tea Party supporter as crazy, but there are within the Tea Party movement some very ugly and mean-spirited and I think very damaging themes. And because people are frightened and because people are angry, they seem to be willing to overlook them too often.
Mm.
So I'm very concerned about what's happening. It's a kind of anything but what we've got now. Let's
change for change's sake.
Let's go for change, no matter what the result. And I think the results could be catastrophic. I think if we put some of the people that are running for office in office and take out some of the professionals that have been there for a long time, and whether or not you like that, at least know what they're doing and have a certain sense of where the nation needs to go. I think we could be headed further into chaos, and that worries me a great deal.
Well, those are worrisome thoughts, and you bring up some good points in there. I'm going to ask you, though, to step back even a little bit farther than 9/11 of 2001. Didn't some of this fracturing in our political discourse really begin at the midterm elections when Newt Gingrich and the Republicans came into power back in the 1990s?
Well, I wouldn't argue with that. We've been headed in the direction for a long time of a real polemic politics, and one that says I can lie and I can cheat and I can steal and I can do anything I have to do to get into power. And once I'm in power, everything will be all right. Well, everything isn't all right when people stoop to those levels and behave in a manner that is so contrary to our fundamental principles. And quite often the people who do that get into power for power's sake rather than for the sake of the good of the country. And as a result, people are feeding at the trough of whatever kind of wealth can come their way, either through the power of wealth, or I should say the wealth of power, or the wealth, economic wealth. And I don't blame people for being upset about millionaires' clubs and people running billionaires' clubs today and people running the country, whether they're elected members of Congress or people who are running huge corporations whose profit margin is the only thing they care about.
We're talking to Mike Farrell, everybody. And Mike, you live here in California, just like the rest of us that are listening to the sound of my voice. And we've got this huge election coming up for governor. And you mentioned the Millionaires Club. I want to just continue along that theme. I mean, if Meg Whitman does get elected to be governor of the state of California, the club's decimal point just moves a couple places to the right and becomes the Billionaires Club. Reality, can our politicians, even the ones that are doing well there, they're part of this Millionaires Club. You have to be $1 million to be in the U.S. Senate. It takes a lot of money to run for president, and as we're finding out, it takes a lot of money to run for the governor of California. Aren't you, just by nature of being a millionaire in that elite top 0.05% of the population, aren't you cut off from the rest of the people that you serve?
Well, of course you are. With a very few exceptions of people who, like the Gateses, who give a great deal of their money, or some other billionaires one can name, but in most instances, there is, you're quite right, there's a great divide between those people and the people who are make up the primary force in this country, the working people, the people who are trying to feed their kids and put them through school and keep a roof over their heads and keep food in their mouths. So I think there's a great problem with that, and it started with the Buckley v. Vallejo, a Supreme Court decision that equated money with speech and said that one can spend as much of one's money as one wants to get elected to the office, which put the billionaires, if you will, into a very, very kind of catbird position where they can simply buy offices. We're seeing that around the country today in Florida, in Wisconsin, in California, where people who Meg Whitman, forgive me, but Meg Whitman didn't even bother to vote for most of her life, and suddenly she wants to run this state. And of course it's going to make a difference in terms of who is given priority, whose concerns are given priority. So I'm very deeply concerned, and the Buckley v. Vallejo decision I mentioned was just, I think, made worse by the Supreme Court in this recent decision where they said corporations could give as much money as they wanted to. It just simply turns over the guiding forces of the country to the people with the most money, and that's exactly contrary to what this country is supposed to be about.
Special interests is driving the whole thing. We're talking to Mike Farrell, everybody. Well, Mike, we've laid out the problem, and I would agree with you that people are angry about this. So that brings us to the next logical conclusion, is what are the solutions?
Well, the solution is to think through the problem and figure out the best way to go about fixing it. And one of the ways, it seems to me, to go about fixing it is insist on a public financing of elections so that people cannot take empty their purses and simply say, I want this office, so I'm going to buy it. Make sure that any member who wants to run for the Congress or the presidency or the United States Senate has to, a campaign must be paid for by U.S. tax dollars. It'll be far cheaper for us, a buck each for people in this country, to set up a pool that would pay for that, and would only be able to have access to the kinds of commercials where they themselves stand up and say what they're about, and would not be able to enhance their campaign by the use of tremendous amounts of money from outside forces. I think that we've got to go for public financing of elections, or we're in deep trouble.
And what countries in the world are doing that today?
There are states that are doing that today here in this country, but I can't tell you what countries are doing it.
All right. Fair enough. Well, Mike, that brings again, interesting point about how we'd go about doing that. What about us as the lay people? I mean, don't we have a role in all of this? Besides the obvious role of going out and voting, what else should we be doing in order to get the political discussion moving forward and on a positive note?
Well, I think the word is discussion. I think we have to be able to talk to each other. I think we have to be able to listen to each other. We have to be able to take part in, town hall meetings in this last go-round, as you know, became kind of shouting matches instead of people having an opportunity to discuss things intelligently. And they became areas wherein people were packing guns to demonstrate their
Second Right Amendment.
Personal animus about certain laws. Aristotle said a long time ago, politics means taking care of the common good of all of the people. And that, it seems to me, is what we need to be about. We need to be involving ourselves on whatever level. It doesn't necessarily mean running for office. It doesn't necessarily mean campaigning for somebody. But getting involved in your community, in your family, in your society, in ways to help other people is the key, and it always has been the key to this country.
No, all politics is local. There's no question about it. We're talking to Mike Farrell, everybody. What about the town hall kind of gatherings that the comedians Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert are trying to put together, where we at least have people come out in a large gathering to show their support of one cause or another? Does that move us in the right direction, in your opinion?
Well, I think that's their hope, and I'm a big fan of both, obviously, both Stewart and Colbert. I'm not sure that in an attempt to appear even-handed, Mr. Stewart evidently said, well, we're going to lose the loonies on the right and the loonies on the left, and he included in the loonies on the left people who are some very strident environmentalists. I think that's a mistake. But but obviously, if he, who has a quite huge audience, can promote rational dialogue between people, I'm all for it.
Great. We're talking to Mike Farrell, everybody. Mike, I mentioned at the outset you're starting in a new play. Can you tell us a little bit about the play and where people can come to see you?
Sure. It's at the Blank Theater in Hollywood, blank.com, for anybody who wants to look it up on the web. It's in Hollywood in this little tiny theaters along Santa Monica Boulevard. The play is called Terre Haute, which is the city in Indiana where the federal prison is located. It's about a meeting, a fictional meeting, between a character based on Gore Vidal and Timothy McVeigh, two characters, based one on Timothy McVeigh and one on Gore Vidal. And it grew out of the fact that Timothy McVeigh, when he was on death row, wrote a letter to Gore Vidal approving of an essay Vidal had written, and it began a correspondence between the two of them. The author of the play took that as the springboard and decided that a Vidal-type character would go in the last 5 days of McVeigh's existence and interview him and get the facts about why he did what he did and if he was involved with other people and that whole thing. So it's a really an interesting little play about two people who are very different discussing this extraordinary event in American history and giving, I think, a different light to it than people would otherwise ascribe to it.
Well, it sounds very thought-provoking. And anybody who wants to find out more, that's blank.com, and they'll get the information about the Blank Theater and the play that you're putting on?
Right.
Very good. Mike, we've only got about 30 seconds left, but I want to get inside you as a person a little bit more, and I want to ask you this question. If I were to ask your wife, Shelley Fabre, about you, how would she describe you?
My wife is a deeply loving and very generous person, so she would describe me in glowing terms that it would make me smile.
Well said. Well done. And I would expect nothing less from you, Mike Farrell. Thank you so much for being my guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
My pleasure, Bill.
Thank you so much.